Postdocs, you know, when you get hired, this is what happens. You're going to give an introduction to string theory. You're going to have to give four lectures on Quarkulum plasma, and that's you know how they receive you. Your interview doesn't stop here. So this lecture, well, string theory is such a huge subject right now that sometimes string theories can't even talk to each other anymore. You know, there are so many areas in string theory. So how do I introduce string theory? So the first part, I'm going to try to do a little bit of string theory, you know, the usual formulation of string theory as a possible high energy description of nature, the thing that you've, you know, probably heard if you don't work in string theory or read in books. And then this is the part where I'm, you know, more my expertise is the gauge gravity duality, which I think is very interesting because it gives us a way of studying strongly coupled gauge theories using classical gravity. I don't know what the cursor's doing there. Oh, okay. All right. So what is our current model of nature? What is called the standard model, at least in the particle physics side. I can barely see this, but this model describes all the known interactions, all the known particles, sorry, that we know. And it's all in the framework of quantum field theory. And in this language, you can write down all the possible interactions for your theory or the Lagrangian of the theory if you give to me the basic gauge symmetries. And in the standard model, the basic gauge symmetries are, as you know, SU3 times SU2 cross U1. And this is the strong force. And this sector is usually called the electroweak interactions. And the fields in the standard model of particle physics are like functions of space and time. And some of them can carry extra indices, like the gauge field, which carries an extra index that goes from 1, 0 to 3, which is the space-time index. But also, they can carry internal indices because these fields transform in some representation of this gauge group. And well, this is just usual quantum mechanics. You just impose some Dirac quantization conditions and, you know, solve the theory. And in practice, what you do is calculate scattering experiments, like you know, this scattering of quarks interacting with the W boson of the electroweak force. So this is what, you know, the model of nature. Of course, this model is needs some input. It's not totally that we can predict anything. We have to make some measurements first to calibrate the model. So this is a list of the 21 or so parameters of the standard model of particle physics with their values. And this is all in units where the Planck constant is 1, g equals 1, and all that. And this is to give you an idea of the range of parameters in this natural unit. They're very small parameters. They're parameters that we know very well, very accurately. There are others that, you know, we don't, like in the Higgs sector, which is the sector we're going to study in the LHC. We don't really know that much those parameters. But once you measure these parameters or give some bounds on them, then and you do this by doing scattering experiments, then you can predict any other scattering process that you want. And this theory is amazingly predictive, and also it's amazingly accurate once you know these numbers. But as beautiful as this theory is, this is not our complete description of nature, because we have another very strange force that everybody here loves. It's gravity. And in gravity, it's described very differently. Instead of a quantum field theory, it's a classical theory of this guy here that's called the metric tensor, which is the object that measures distances in space-time. Think of this as like a generalized trigonometric, the Pythagorean theorem. So this theory is classical and can also be formulated in terms of an action. And this action is comprised of this is the Ricci scalar of the metric, which is a function of the metric and its first derivative. And it's a nonlinear function. And this is the determinant of the four-dimensional metric. So if you vary this action with respect to the metric, you get what it's called Einstein equations. Now, this is an action just like the actions that you have in quantum field theory. It's a local theory. The metric is a function of space and time. So you might think that you can construct a quantum field theory of gravity. However, if you try to do that, for instance, you can try to expand around flat space and look at the flux and quantize the fluctuations of the metric, you find that your theory is what is called non-renormalizable. That means that usually in quantum field theory, as many of you know, or probably all of you know, you get infinities from this kind of loop diagrams. However, you can always absorb these infinities in a redefinition of the constants, the coefficients in the Lagrangian. However, in general relativity, we don't have, the only coefficient that we will have here is the Newton's constant at the front of the action. We don't have anything more. And it turns out that if you try to absorb all these infinities, you have to add more and more terms to this action. And in fact, you have to add infinite number of terms to be able to absorb all these infinities. So the theory becomes non-predictable. However, you can see it as an effective field theory coming from a more fundamental theory that we would like to know which one is that theory. Now, even, I mean, the general relativity is very accurate in terms of classical physics, classical gravity, but even this construction of quantum field theory on one side and general relativity cannot be enough because, well, the problem that I just told you about quantum gravity, but even more important than that, and this is, well, a problem that it's already there, this is what cosmologists and astrophysicists are telling us, that the normal matter of the standard model is only about 4% of the total energy of the universe. So this is ridiculous. You look at this and say, well, we know nothing about the universe. We have all this sector here of 21% of something called dark matter. We can see its presence by studying, you know, lensing, rotational curves of galaxies. And we have all this other guy here called the dark energy, although this guy you could probably get away by putting a cosmological constant in Einstein equation, although you have to fine-tune it incurably, but you know, you can say, okay, I can get away with that. But at least this guy, you cannot get away by anything in the standard model can explain the dark matter. So obviously, this description of nature is very, it's still open, it's not complete, although it's very accurate to our experiments on Earth. So we need something better. Now, let's talk a little bit about, go back to the problem of quantum gravity, because quantum gravity is non-renormalizable. Well, this is not the first theory that people have studied that is non-renormalizable. In the old days of quantum field theory, when people were studying the weak interactions, and so people had this beta decay, observed this beta decay in experiments, and if you look at this diagram in terms of quantum field theory, this is a four fermion interaction. And if you know your quantum field theory, you know that this interaction is non-renormalizable. So what was the solution? Of course, the solution in the standard model is that this interaction is only an effective interaction. What happens is that you have extra degrees of freedom propagating here. So what you have is this other interaction, which is renormalizable. So this is an interaction of two, it's a Yukawa-type interaction between a boson and two fermions. And so you have an interaction like this, and this can explain the beta decay by normalizable, renormalizable quantum field theory. And because of the W boson is very massive, what you get is at very low energy looks something like this. So what about gravity? Maybe there's something like this. We can add some more matter to the standard model of our Lagrangian to make gravity renormalizable. However, you can try to do that in many ways, and it doesn't work. There's no way of adding extra fields to quantum field theory to make a local quantum field theory of gravity. So what do we do?
What does local quantum field theory? Well, a theory like this based on an action. So what I'm saying is if you can add more matter, and all the matter be local like this in space-time. So all local fields in space-time, and do the usual quantization. So, I mean, you can imagine coupling this to scalars. So that. All right, so string theory makes a bold conjecture. We don't know if it's true, but it is certainly very beautiful once you go through it and realize that it actually works pretty nicely. And we gave away something very special, which is locality. And there are many ways of getting to this topic of non-locality. So what I mean by non-locality here is it's just very simple. I'm going to replace that quantum field theory, which is defined, so the fields are defined at a point, instead of a theory of strings, where we have this one-dimensional objects propagating in space-time. So instead of having these point particles, I'm going to have this string, and think of this as time flowing in the upper direction. So I have a scattering of two strings, and giving away to more strings. Now, this is the basic object of this theory, the basic tool that you use in particular string theory is what's called the nonlinear sigma model. This is a two-dimensional field theory. Now, this theory is the theory of this this membrane type object you see here, this is the what we call the world sheet, is basically the generalization of the world line of a particle. So in quantum field theory, basically what you're doing is summing over all possible paths of these particles. And in string theory, what we do is sum over all possible shapes of this world volume. And the way to do that is defining this two-dimensional sigma model, which has the target space. This is the metric of space-time, right? So this, the indices mu and nu go to whatever the dimensions of space-time. And this sigma 1, 2 are the two coordinates that we use to parameterize this two-dimensional surface. So you can, and then this x mu here is basically the coordinates of the string, the embedding of the string in space-time. And it depends on the two coordinates here. If there's any question, please.
And we can add other fields to this apart from the metric. It's called the B field, some antisymmetric tensor. That is also a function of this embeddings. And because I'm going to discuss a little bit more, this sigma model has conformal invariance. You can also couple. This is the Ricci scalar for the two-dimensional metric, which is gamma. And this phi is some scalar field we call the dilaton. And it's going to basically control the loops of string theory. Right. So this is our basic object. Let's suppose that I give you this. I don't tell you why. I just give you this model. And we want to quantize this and to define a theory of strings, like this scattering of strings and all that. So how do we do that? Yeah.
So what would B represent?
Excuse me?
What would B mu nu represent? What is it?
Mu nu
B. So G is the metric of the target space.
It's going to become more clear. I'm going to define an effective action. This is like a generalization of electromagnetism, for instance. In string theory, we have like forms that, in electromagnetism, you have a one form, which is the Gaussian field. Yeah. In string theory, we have generalization. This is like a two form. And so these are generalization for electromagnetism. So you're going to have gravity coupled to other fields.
So that's related to my second question, which is, is that the all right, this should be answered by no. Is that the action for string theory, or is that just some simple, easy thing?
All right, this is the action for perturbative string. Actually, I haven't added the firmness here. So this is bosonic string theory.
Okay.
All right, so what is string theory? We don't know. Right. String theory is a very complete theory, and it actually has a lot of non-perturbative phenomena. Like I'm going to talk about deep brains and all that, right? The way that people first understood string theory was in this language. This is perturbative string theory, where we only talk about S matrices and string scattering. But there are many other things that cannot be described by this simple action. And I'm going to talk about that. We don't have a full non-perturbative definition of string theory.
Another quick question. When you said you sum over the shapes of the world sheets, I assume you mean you're summing over the topology?
Yes.
Not the actual lengths or...
No, actually, yeah. So the length it's not important because this theory, as I will argue, showing that this has conformal invariance, so the actual volume of this thing is totally meaningless, right? So you gauge fix that, but you should, yeah, you sum over all shapes, all genuses. These are Riemann surfaces, and actually this guy here will basically count in the path integral will give you something like an exponential over like the genus of the surface, right? So you're gonna have like some or genuses. And this guy will give you a weighting factor for all the genuses. Right?
So then these are always orientable surfaces?
You can have non-orientable too.
Okay.
I'm not gonna get into those details, but you can have non-orientable, yeah. Certainly. Actually you have to sum over everything. You have to sum over all of them. All right, so let's see, classically, this theory, if you look back here, has very simple two-dimensional diffeomorphism invariance. Right? So it's a coordinate invariant. You can change coordinates, and it's obviously invariant under that. But there's another invariance, which is scale invariance. And so I can take the metric and we scale it by some function of the tau and sigma, the coordinates on the world volume, the world sheet. And the action is invariant under that. And the thing is that these two symmetries, we call them, the sum of those is called the conformal invariance. It's very important, actually. It's going to be the central topic of perturbative string theory. So let's try to quantize this to see what we get. So let's do it in flat space. So my action reduces to this. And let me forget about the B field and the dilaton for now, just for simplicity. And I pick some coordinates. So I pick my metric on the world sheet to be just flat metric. So I have very simple equations of motions. Just, you know, these are just traveling waves. So I can expand my embedding in terms of a right-handed and left-handed movers. And this is my definition for this coordinate sigma plus minus. So I just expand in Fourier modes. This is just all classical expansion in Fourier modes. And here, so you can see that this x mu here is basically the center of mass of the string. And these guys are basically the vibration of the string, right? And this is the momentum of the string. But this is just Fourier expansion. Now, if you quantize this, I mean, this is a very simple theory. It's a free theory. You know, it's a quadratic theory. You can quantize it. You get that all these Fourier coefficients, just like you do in quantum field theory, they have some commutation relations. And especially x and p are precisely, you know, position and momentum. And because of conformal invariance, you want this to be a symmetry of the quantum theory. So you have to, at a classical level, conformal invariance means that the stress energy tensor is zero. So we have to impose this as a constraint acting on state. And so the zero mode of this constraint in Fourier space give you this relation between the mass and space-time. And here the mass is basically the square of the four momentum and the oscillators. And I'm glossing over subtleties of how you get this constant and all that. So I don't want to get into those details. So basically, this is my mass formula for any state in the string theory. So let's look at the lowest energy states.
I have the vacuum state labeled by K is basically the momentum. I should put a P instead of K. I'm sorry for the confusion, but this K is just this P. I can label my center of mass point string by that. And this vacuum, if you plug it here, has a mass that is negative, mass squared that is negative. So this is a tachyonic state. But also you have this kind of combinations that these are massless states, and basically these are the gravitons. So this epsilon symbol is not the antisymmetric. This you can, the symmetric part of this will give you the graviton. The antisymmetric part will give you the B field, and the trace will give you the dilaton. So these are the massless states of the bosonic string, and you can see right here how you get the spin two particle from string theory, and that's how we get the graviton. So notice that just by promoting particles to strings, I have all these vibrational modes that behave like particles as seen from the point of view of the target space. But conformal invariance is actually very powerful. You can define S matrices to scatter the strings, these gravitons and all that. And as someone already pointed out, you have to sum over all topologies of this world sheet, and this is basically, you know, sum over genesis. However, conformal invariance can only be obtained in certain dimension. For a pure bosonic string, the one that I talked about, the dimension has to be 26. If you add the fermions, you get that you only can have this beautiful symmetry that allows you to do all these beautiful things only in D equals 10. Now, when you construct scattering states, like S matrices, you know that you can relate S matrices to an effective action. You can think of this as scattering in space-time, right? So the question is, what is the effective action that gives you this same expansion? And you can actually reconstruct that systematically, and that's how we see gravity arising as a low energy limit of string theory. So you get the Ricci curvature, and this is in the target space, so D here should be 26 for the bosonic string, or 10 for, well, this is only bosonic string, so D should be 26. So you get gravity, and you get this dilaton field, which is some scalar in the background. And this H basically is this three form that is related basically to the B form, like a D of the B of the two form. So you get gravity coupled to scalar and some higher form. And this is for the closed string. It's all for the closed string. And this is an expansion in alpha prime. And maybe I didn't tell this, but alpha prime is the only parameter in this theory. It's some unit of length square, and it basically gives you the string scale.
Variance, or is it just nice?
Okay, it's a good question. I guess. it's related to Lorentz symmetry. We want to have, well, one of the things, okay, first, it's nice. It's like a point of an enhanced symmetry. You can get all these things. But if you want to have a vacuum, that Minkowski spacetime is the vacuum of the theory, you need to be in the critical dimension. Otherwise, you can get conformal invariance back, but you're going to have to add an extra field because the wild anomaly will come haunt you, and it's going to behave just like an extra embedding coordinate.
Okay, but why do you need conformal invariance? Why do you need it at all?
No, well, it's very useful to define. I mean, you can. It's very useful to define this S matrix. To define the S matrix and all that is the only way that we know exactly how to define the S matrix of a string theory and all that.
But what I'm asking is it a mathematical convenience motivation, or is it some sort of physical motivation that, you know, does the theory break if you don't have conformal invariance, or is it just hard or maybe even impossible to calculate?
We don't know exactly how can you can always restore conformal invariance.
No, but that's not what I'm asking. What I'm asking is, do you need conformal invariance? Like, do you want it for some reason?
Is it a necessary
condition? Is it required physically?
We don't understand the theory without it. Let's put it
that way. Okay. I don't know. But so maybe the classical equations are that given U is to be equal to zero. So
it's like in the standard model. You start with a theory with certain classical symmetry. You want to check that there are no anomalies to that symmetry. Otherwise, you should have started with something else, right? So if I tell you that I start with a polyhedral action that describes the motion of a string in the background, which this action is basically, classically, the action is telling you that you're looking for the minimal area surface, right?
Yeah.
Right? So if I tell you that is my action to start with, and then I find that the theory breaks the classical symmetries, then I should have started with some, I mean, I could start with anything then. So there's no constraint. Uh-huh. See what I'm saying? That you could, you didn't have to start with that particular action anyways. So you can have something totally crazy.
So you want the quantum
and then I don't have the interpretation of.
So you want the quantum to have the same symmetries as the
quantum. Right. That's always the case when you do quantum field theory.
I mean, I think people do look for string theories which they say have to be diffeomorphism invariant on the world sheet, but not vial invariant. And then it's just, I mean, they've never got luck.
But you can always restore it, right? But then
people do try to. Okay.
But you can always restore it, right? But you get the. You get the scalar factor will behave like an extra field in your.
That's right, like a U.
Okay, right. So right. The U will field, and then we don't. If you look at it from a space-time perspective, it seems like you have an extra dimension that is not. You don't have the only geometries that arise at low energy are not. It's not Minkowski. Minkowski would not be the. It's gonna be always Minkowski times some or other coordinate.
That's what you want.
Yeah. Okay.
Thanks.
All right, so let's talk a little bit about, just briefly, about the gauge interactions. In string theory, we also have open strings and D-brains. D-brains are basically membrane-type objects. This is where the open strings can end, and these are non-perturbative objects. These are like the solitons of string theory. And open strings correspond to small vibration of the D-brains. And these open strings carry an index in the end. It's called a Champaton factor, which tells you in which D-brain they end. You can have a stack of D-brains. And if the D-brains are on top of each other, you have a point of symmetry where you have an enhanced UN gauge symmetry in the target space. And you can derive an effective action to study the scattering of strings, just like with it studying the scattering of closed strings. You can derive an action for these open strings, and you get basically Yang-Mills action. So this is also how string theory encodes gauge interactions. Now, I'm not going to say too much about how to actually construct realistic, well, semi-realistic models of nature, but of course, if string theory has 10 dimensions or you know, 11, whatever, it depends on your formulation, then you have to somehow compactify and hide these dimensions. So you have to compactify six of those dimensions, like the easiest way would be in V-Tori. And a popular model that people use to get semi-realistic particle physics, and so you have this flat space here times this V-Tori that are supposed to be very small compared to the natural scales of physics that you're making experiments here. So the effective theory will look four-dimensional. And then you can wrap some brains in some cycles. And for instance, you can wrap V6 brains on the cycles on the T2. And then you get, for instance, this is a class of models that's known as intersecting V6 brains. And usually you get this chiral fermions in the intersection, you get family replication of the gauge group of the fermions, and you get gauge groups that are basically products of UN gauge groups. And I mean, you can do many other things. I mean, this is like, it's nothing. People can do orbit flows and try to come up with models that are very sort of close, not exactly the standard model, but they can come, you know, pretty close to it. Depends on your view. But so this is, you know, a way, it's very involved. And the thing is that there's so many ways of doing this. This is the problem of the landscape. You know that, let me go back to this action, although this is just the bosonic, it's not the super spring, but the metric where string theory can propagate has to obey the equations of motion that come from this action to get a conformal invariant theory. So, I mean, there's so many ways, there are many solutions with compact dimensions. You can have any Calabi-Yau here. So this is what's called the problem of the landscape. Depends what you put here, and there's so many constructions. You can choose different types of D-brain and all that, and fluxes. And you get all this vacua of possible universes that string theory tells you that they could be there, but we haven't found exactly our universe. So this is the big problem in phenomenology, how to get to our universe. What is the correct construction? What are the correct ingredients, especially if you want to put cosmology and all in the question? So this is the what's called the landscape.
I have a question. I always hear the term Calabi-Yau manifold thrown around, and I don't actually know what one is. Is there a physical, what's the physical motivation for restricting to this?
Supersymmetry, yeah.
Okay.
Always first thing, yeah. All right, so that's a very brief introduction of string theory as fundamental theory, and I think pretty much everybody here sort of knew that already or heard about it. No? Okay. So any questions so far? Like, I don't know. I don't know how much time I have. I want to know, all right, people against string theory.
That's a stupid question. So you said you need 26 dimensions for bosonic string. When you add it can be reduced to 10. Why is there a dramatic decreasing?
It's well, so from, I don't know if I should go into these details. Let me see if there's a quick way. If you look at the anomaly, the anomaly for the conformal invariance, it's basically that the bosons and fermions will contribute to that anomaly with the opposite sign, put it that way. So if you add fermions, you're like adding negative to that anomaly, so you can sort of cancel.
So if you have more fermions, you can cancel out.
Yeah, you can cancel it out, and it's sort of linear in the dimensionality of the space-time. So,
The super ghosts can be more negative.
It has to do with when you want to cancel the anomaly, the conformal anomaly. All right, so let's talk a little bit about the gauge gravity duality. Now, this is a sort of a newer topic in string theory. This is going, you know, a little bit away of even if you don't believe in string theory as a fundamental theory, even if it doesn't work like that, string theory has found a way to, an application of string theory is to study strongly coupled gauge theories, and this is very interesting. And this is known as the ABS-CFT duality or the gauge theory gravity duality. And to look at this, let me go back to this D-brain. So there are two equivalent descriptions of D-brains. One is through open strings, tell you that if I scatter open strings on D-brains, I get a gauge theory and the word volume of these D-brains. So if these D-brains are D3 brains, it means that the word volume is four-dimensional, and I get a four-dimensional gauge theory. However, there's a different way of looking at the same system where I have a closed string description of D-brains. So if I get a stack of D-brains and I let the number of D-brains go to infinity, I can replace the stack of D-brains by some back-reactive geometry. Because in string theory, remember this is a complete theory, so deep brains also back react. I mean, they can absorb and emit closed strings, and closed strings are basically the gravitons. One of the states of the closed string is the graviton. So you can imagine that putting a lot of deep brains, if you do this correctly, should lead to some geometry, very curved geometry. And in fact, if you put n degree brains in type 2D string theory in flat space, you get that the close to this deep range, the space-time is basically anti-de-Sitter geometry, which is a space-time negative cosmological constant. So these two descriptions suggest that one should have some sort of duality between a gauge theory with UN gauge group and gravity on asymptotically anti-de-Sitter space-time. And this is known as the SDFT duality. Now, the first concrete example, this was suggested long time ago, but the first concrete example within the context of string theory was given in 1997 by Malacena. And this is, you put, again, a stack of n D3 brains of type 2B string theory, and on the word volume of these D brains, you get a theory which is called n equals 4 supersymmetric Young-Mills theory. And it's actually defined in a compact space, which is times a three-sphere, and the gauge group UN. So this is the theory with maximal supersymmetry that you can have in four dimensions. And it's actually scale invariant theory, so conformal field theory. And here, conformal is not the same as the conformal invariance is not the same as the one in the world here. This is totally different conformal invariance. So this is a conformal field theory, also known as CFT. And then on the other hand, the closed string description is if you take n to infinity, the near horizon limit of this D3 brains is basically ADS5 cross S5. So here, the time is in the vertical direction, and the circle here is basically the S3, which is the same S3 as enters in the gauge theory. And there's a radial direction here. This is the center of ADS. This is the boundary of ADS. And this is the phi sphere. So it was suggested by Malacena that we should have a duality between the gauge theory, the states in this theory, and the states of quantum gravity on this asymptotically space-time. So that's why I draw the closed strings here. You can have excitations, and this should be a way of describing these excitations by using the gauge theory. Now, just don't have to understand all the Lagrangian here, but just to give you a glimpse of how the variables in the Lagrangian are related to the D-brains, so you have this sector here. Basically, the open strings give this rise to the sector of the gauge field here, and the fermions. So this basically corresponds to motion in the directions of the D brains, like the scattering of the open strings. And there are also six scalar fields. So I here goes to one from 1 to 6, and these scalar fields basically parameterize the motion transverse to the D3 brains. And notice that this part of the Lagrangian, in particular, has a global symmetry, which is a SO6 that rotates all the scalar. This is known as an R symmetry. It's actually an exact symmetry of the theory. The fermions also transform under that symmetry.
A connected covering group?
It's SU4. It's SU4.
Okay.
It's SU4. That's
all right.
That's correct. But I just want to make it more intuitive. Now, there's a catch here, of course. This is actually an inferent UV duality. So if you want to look at high energies in one of the theories, you have to look at low energies in the other. And how do we see this? So in this Malacena construction, you can relate the couplings at both sides of the theory. Here R is the characteristic radius of a anti-de-Sitter and a sphere, an alpha prime is the string scale. And lambda is called the Zuhut coupling of the gauge theory, which is a product of n, which is the rank of the gauge group, and the coupling of the gauge theory. And you have that n is related to the 10-dimensional Planck scale over the scale of anti-de-Sitter space. And Young-Mills coupling is related to the string coupling, which this string coupling is basically the exponential of minus the dilaton. So this is related to the dilaton is constant in this solution. So you can tune this parameter. You can tune n. So let's see. If I want to have gravity, classical gravity in the ball, do you have a question? Sorry.
Do you have to think the two radius to be the same, or?
It turns out to be the same in this model. Yeah. But yes, in this part, yes. The radius of the sphere and the ADS, yes, in this model, but there are other models that it's not the case.
Still you have the dual.
And still you have, yeah. But this is a very simple, like the simplest case we know. So it will be cool to be able to tune it, because then you can make it very small and get like four-dimensional gravity. But it's not that easy. So suppose we want to get classical gravity on onto the Sitter space. So we need that the radius of ADS be much larger than the Planck scale.
So we need to take n to infinity. We also want to suppress the alpha prime corrections. Remember that I wrote this effective action for string theory had all these alpha prime corrections. So we want to keep like the lowest term, which is Einstein, just pure Einstein gravity. So for that, we need to make alpha prime very small. So we need to take also the two-hooped coupling to be large. But this is very hard. In the gauge theory, large n is not that bad, but large two-hooped coupling means strongly coupled gauge theory. So this is one of the curses and blessings of this, because on the one hand, it's hard to make computations in the gauge theory at strong coupling, but then we can use classical gravity to study the gauge theory at large two-hoof coupling. All right, so let's try to see how one sees the emergence of geometry and all that. It's not that simple, but at least I'll give you sort of a glimpse of how do we understand this duality more at the detail level. See, I don't know how much time we have. All right, so suppose the theory is defined in R cross S3. So it's time times the sphere, the tree sphere. This is the Young-Mills theory. So let's take any field. Here I'm working with a scalar field, but you can take any other fields, and you decompose it in spherical harmonics on the sphere. And this index just runs over the representations of SO4, right? And these spherical harmonics are solutions to Laplacian, and you know they're normalized the usual way. So the action at quadratic level, you also have the interactions. It's just a bunch of harmonic oscillators. So this is just standard quantum field theory, right? And the thing is that you can classify the states by the quantum numbers SO4, which is the A here, and SO6, which is the R symmetry of the theory that I told you, this global symmetry that transforms the scalars. Right. Now, if I go to the dual, now I'm in the space-time picture, this classification of states by SO4 times SO6 is the same as the classification of states in ADS 5 cross S5. So this SO4 is the rotational group on this S3 embedded in S5, and the SO6 is the rotational group on the S5. So we start seeing sort of a matching of the global symmetries here. And let me take an example, a particular example. If you take the zero mode of one of the scalars on the S3, and the zero, by zero mode, I mean the one with n equals zero, so, and forget about the index. So let me take the zero mode of two of the complex scalars. So this corresponds in the dual picture to a string or states. I don't want to say string yet, but this is a state of the quantum gravity where I have some wave function that is sort of localized at the center of ADS, and it's carrying two angular momenta on the S5, one in two up orthogonal directions in the S5. And in the gauge theory, you can write down these states like using just the oscillators for the zero modes. You can have multiple traces acting on the vacuum of the gauge theory. Now, this is very heuristic. I mean, I haven't shown you that this is actually a string state or anything like that. So how do we see that? How do we start to see the emergence of the string from this state? Is that clear so far, the thing with the zero mode? And because the notation gets worse now. If you get lost, please just tell.
Okay, perfect. All right, which work exactly?
Well, better.
Oh, yeah. Okay, perfect. All right, so it's not bad. All right, so you understand. So this is fine so far. You expand any field in the field theory in spherical harmonics, so you get this action, right? So this is an action of harmonic oscillator, right? So you can define a add that like a dagger a, you know, the creation annihilation operator for every one of the modes, right? So what I did here, I just took the zero mode and I forgot. So this index here is the confusing thing. This index is just to label two of the different scalars is not to label the representation on the SO4, SO4. So I because it's the zero mode, right? So these are just two usual harmonic oscillators, but they're matrix value. So maybe I didn't say that very clearly, but all the fields in Yang-Mills theory are in the adjoint representation of UN. So they all carry two indices. These indices run from 1 to n. So they're all matrices, all of them. So that's why I have to put the trace to make a Gaussian invariant state. Right? So that's all. This is just harmonic oscillator for the zero mode of two of the scalars. Now, if I take that, I start to look at this thing and say, this looks like a spin chain. Well, I know it's a little bit of a stretch, but yeah, you can label one of those oscillators by up spin and the other one by a down spin, and if you get an array of them, you can map this to a state of a Heisenberg spin chain. Of course, you have to keep in mind this has periodic boundary conditions because the trace is cyclic. Now, if you go to the weakly coupled gauge theory and try to calculate the Hamiltonian that acts on this state, how does it act to leading order in lambda, you find that amazingly it does act like a spin chain. So in the large end limit, so it's very important that you take the large end limit. In the large end limit, when you act with the Hamiltonian, it only acts on nearest neighbors. And that comes about because in the large end limit, if you try to interact this guy with some other guy right here, this is suppressed by like 1 over n squared factor. So in the large end limit, there's a beautiful simplicity in the Hamiltonian in this sector. Just the Heisenberg spin chain, and lambda is just the 2 of Compton. So the total number of spins or letters in this word is the total number, the total angular momentum in the dual spacetime. Remember that I told you that R charge is the same as the angular momentum, and each one of these guys carries a unit of R charge in a different direction. So if you have 10 of them, you're going to have 10 units of angular momentum, and it could be in two different directions depending on how many y's and z's sets you have here. Now let's try to see the emergence of the sigma model, the actual world sheet of the string. So the only way we can do this at a weak coupling is if we take some thermodynamic limit. So in this case, we take a limit of large angular momentum. Or in other words, in the gauge theory, we take a lot of spins, very large letter, very large single trace operator. Now I can build coherent states for each spin state. And there's a prescription well known in condensed matter to construct an action for coherent states. And it turns out that the action has this form. This is very general for any type of coherent state. And if I plug this coherent state and my Hamiltonian of the spin chain here, I get the following. And C here is it's a one form. And the thing here is that you see that in the thermodynamic limit, I can basically replace L by a smooth parameter over the string, and I get the following sigma model, where now lambda twiddle is this reduced coupling constant. So in the limit, if I take J to infinity, and at the same time scale lambda to infinity with this parameter fixed and small, I can get a perturbative expansion in the sigma model like this. And you see that J going to infinity is basically a classical limit. This gives you like an inverse of a Planck's constant. Now, this doesn't look exactly like the sigma model that I showed to you at the beginning, but there is a way of getting this from that sigma model. In fact, it was first shown by Kuczynski in 2003 that if you take a string in the same limit, large angular momentum along the S5, and you scale your two-loop variable in such a way that you make this guy fixed and small as you take J to infinity, you actually get exactly this same action that I just showed you here. So you can match exactly what you get from the Yang-Mills theory to what you get from the Polyakov action. And so you see that the emergence of the closed string. And this effective parameter was first actually discovered before Kuczynski by Bernstein, Mandelstein, and Nastassi in this very famous paper, and it's known as the BMN limit, where you take this guy to the fixed and small. So that's how you see the strings. Now let's try to look a little bit further
and try to see the emergence of the geometry, of the space-time geometry, and directly try to do it directly at strong coupling. So doing calculations in strong coupling is very difficult, but there's some techniques that you can use. They're not very rigorous, but they seem to give the correct result. Now, if we want to look at supersymmetric states, these states obey some bound. They saturate a bound that's called the BPS bound. So if you take your Hamiltonian and J here is the generator of the arc charge, which is the same as angular momentum in the spacetime. So a state that satisfies this equality, it's a BPS state. So I want to study these states in the gauge theory. So how do we do that and try to do it at strong coupling? So one can show at the classical level, so if you look at the Young-Mills action at the classical level, only for the scalar fields, you can show that this kind of states classically can only be described at scalar fields, but they also have to commute. Because the commutator here adds to the Hamiltonian a positive energy, but it doesn't add to the arc charge. So this is at the classical level. So one can guess and say, and by the way, the scalars have to be the zero mode. Only the zero mode of the scalars and the commuting matrices. So this is the only way to get BPS state at the classical level in Young-Mills. So you say, maybe I should expand around this configuration and do perturbation theory at strong coupling. So Bernstein proposed that we should make a perturbation theory around commuting matrices, and this should be a perturbation at strong coupling in the gauge theory. So, and this should be actually a good perturbation theory because you can show that the commutator gives like the very big contribution in the large lambda limit. So that if you want to look at the lowest energy states in the gauge theory, this should be given by these commuting matrices. So we should study quantum mechanics of commuting matrices. Is everybody with me? At this point, it's getting bad, you know. It's getting bad, it's going downhill. All right, so to recap, we want to study these supersymmetric states, and I gave you no reason why I want to do it, but they're easier, that's why. And these states will be corresponds to, you know, state in the gravity dual. It will be like ADS5 plus 5 will be one of these supersymmetric states and all this stuff. So I'm claiming that those states should be described by model of quantum mechanics of commuting matrices. All right, so that's what we have. Now, so this is my Hamiltonian at three level, and because these are supersymmetric states, and because the commutator is zero, we should not have any additional interaction here. So we need to take into account this constraint. So we go to the eigenvalue basis, and you can derive a Hamiltonian for the eigenvalues of the matrices. And it takes this form where this mu is coming basically from the Jacobian of this transformation going to the eigenvalue basis. So this is supposedly the Hamiltonian that describes BPS states in Young-Mills. So let me give you an example how you get the ADS5 crosses 5. Well, you won't be able to see the full geometry, but at least there's a very simple calculation where you can see the emergence of the S5. So let's look at the ground state. The ground state should be ADS5 crosses 5, right? So the ground state wave function is this. You can actually calculate it's exact. This is the ground state of that Hamiltonian, and it takes the following exponential form. Now, if you look at the large n limit, remember we need large n limit to be able to compare with geometry. So you can replace these sums by integrals over some distribution of eigenvalues. This is a standard problem in condensed matter. So you get this square of the wave function takes this form. And then you can use the saddle point approximation because these exponentials are very large. And because it's negative of some positive exponential, you know, the leading contribution will be the saddle point of this. So the saddle point is this equation, integral equation for the density of eigenvalues. Subject, of course, this constant comes from this constraint. You want to, the total number of eigenvalues is n, of course. So we now need to find the eigenvalue distribution of the ground state using this formula. And you find that it is actually a singular distribution of precisely an S5, so it embedded in R6. And you can even calculate the radius of this S5. And so the claim is that this S5 is basically the S5 of the spacetime. This is how you see it in the gauge theory. Now, this is a big claim. I mean, how do we start to check this? So one thing is that you can add excitations around this S5 and try to look at the energies of those excitations and see if it matches with the string theory calculations. So I can take some off-diagonal mode in the background of that eigenvalue distribution, and you can show that the Hamiltonian at the quadratic level takes this form. And so they have masses that depend on the eigenvalue, the eigenvalues of the background matrices. Now, if you consider a state like this, this is like a plane wave state. So basically, there are two excitations here. These are off-diagonal excitations in the background of the diagonal excitations times the ground state wave function. And we add some phase here. So this is like a magnon in the spin chain picture. So this state, you can visualize it as, so the eigenvalues, I draw like red dots. So this is the eigenvalue distribution, the S5. And you can see these guys here like string bits, so bits of strings joining eigenvalues. And of course, there's a sum over all the eigenvalues, so you have to sum. I mean, I put a lot here, but here I only have two of them. And they must form a closed loop because of the trace of the state. So this is basically a trace here. That's why I have to sum over both indices. So this is how we describe some of these excitations around the commuting background. And then there's a slide here of gibberish. And so what you do is that you can calculate the average energy of such a state, right? And the point that I want to make here is that if you use the saddle point approximation for the wave function, you can change the integrals in flat space by integrals over the distribution of eigenvalues. And then if you take the large J limit, this J here, if you take the large angular momentum limit or R charge limit, these guys here localize, they're maximal when these coordinates obey this relation. So they're maximal when theta is one of the asymptotal coordinate in the S5, and this the polar coordinate, and these are the asymptotal coordinates in the S5. So the moral here is that at the end, you can calculate, after you do this calculation, you can show that the energy of such string beat takes this very simple form, where this is the separation of the ends of the string in the S5. And when I say string, I'm overusing notation, because so far these are just states of the Yang-Mills theory. So we get some sort of picture of some state that looks like a bit that joins two eigenvalues in the equator when the angular momentum goes to infinity. Now, it was then found by Maldacena and Hoffman. They found some classical string solutions that have exactly the same behavior. They're called giant magnons, and they join two points on the equator, and they have exactly the same dispersion relation. So this matches this calculation that we thought that we were doing in strongly coupled Yang-Mills theory. So we see that the energy is exactly the same, and the sort of the physical interpretation. So it does make sense that the geometries arising at strong coupling in the gauge theory by these condensates of eigenvalues, and the off-diagonal elements of the fields are basically the strings. So these are the lessons that I just want to forget about the details. The lesson so far is that to see the emergence of gravity at strong coupling in the gauge theory, you have to study this distribution of eigenvalues of these matrices, and the off-diagonal elements are basically the strings. Any questions so far?
Okay. Stand down. Okay. Alright. Well, I have a whole section on this. This is an impossible, it's perfect there.
The ADS CFT correspondence, you said you wanted to check it. Is it not? Is it conjecture or is it proven?
Name checks, but it's probably Maldacena injections. Actually, I should have skipped the whole part, and I didn't know. Like, I finished this like 5 minutes ago. I didn't know how much time did I have, anything. So I should have skipped to this part, which I think is the most interesting part. But
we can summarize that in like two sentences.
All right, two sentences.
Two slides, two sentences.
Okay, so there is Rick. Then there is the fourth. No. All right, so the point here is that because we have this duality between strongly coupled gauge theories and gravity, we can use this to learn something about strongly coupled gauge theories, especially in the thermal phase. So for instance, we want to know what are the properties of a thermal plasma in strongly coupled QCD. We don't have a description of strongly coupled QCD as a gauge, as a string theory yet. But we have Yang-Mills theory is actually not that different when you go at high temperatures. And it behaves like a plasma has some transport coefficients. It's described by hydrodynamics. So we can start to compare, basically at the hydrodynamic level, what is the hydrodynamics of Yang-Mills theory maybe compared to what people see at these experiments. And these experiments, what they do, let me just show you a quick, a nice movie, and that's it. I can't find the cursor.
It's on the
page. Oh, it's there. Oh, okay, I can see it. Wow, that was quick.
Well, these things happen on 10 to 6.
I was missing it. Okay, so this is a collision of two gold nuclei at Rick. Well, the simulation of a collision of two gold nuclei. And the thing is, these guys are traveling almost at the speed of light. So they're at 2 GeV center of mass. And the thing is that when they collide, and this thing doesn't want to respond like as usual, so you saw that all that garbage that came. So that plasma that you see there is actually very well described by hydrodynamics. So one can start to ask questions: what are the transport? What is the shear viscosity? What is the relaxation time of this plasma? And try to do a model of that in a gauge theory, which is a toy model, but it does give you results that are not that different from the actual experiment. So it is one of the only places where you can actually study strongly coupled plasmas in use analytical techniques. So it's a very useful thing. It complements the whole lattice gauge theory approach. So
what's the viscosity then?
Lattice. Okay, so So okay, so if you look at the response of the stress energy tensor, if you put a perturbation like in the plasma, right? If you look at the response of the stress energy tensor, there are some coefficients that in Fourier space that depends on. So if you look at this in Fourier space, hydrodynamics tells you that you should get something like this. So that this term here we call it the shear viscosity. It's like a coefficient in the hydrodynamic equations. And the next term is like something with a relaxation time that tells you how this fluid relaxes to equilibrium. And if you compare with the string theory, this is a calculation that you do in gravity, using gravity only, you can match the structure. So you can read off the shear viscosity, you can read off the relaxation time. And then you can keep checking the validity of hydrodynamics, which is something that I'm very interested in. And you can actually see that it breaks down at some point. This local hydrodynamics don't work anymore. And so that's, you know, the kind of thing that you do. And there are many other things. I mean, it's the tip of the iceberg.
Are there other questions? If not, then let's thank someone.